Wired Jesus Podcast, January 11th, 2007. Creative Commons licensed.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
Wired Jesus Podcast.
I walk a lonely road, the only one that I have ever known. Don't know where it goes, but it's only me and I walk alone.
Wired wanderings of a postmodern pilgrim.
And you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee.
Well, I don't like your God. Your God scares me.
My boy, we're pilgrims in an unholy land.
Hello, and welcome to the Wired Jesus Podcast, the wired wanderings of a postmodern pilgrim. I'm your host and fellow traveler, Tom Lieberg, and glad to have you along on the journey. Well, it's a new year, and it's been a few weeks since the last podcast. And in looking ahead, got my hands full with a number of things coming up. If you follow the blog on the webpage, I lead a pastor's conference down in Orlando in 2 weeks and leave for Florida next week. And then also, we're working to host the very first U2 Eucharist using a live band. I'll be doing a podcast on that in a week or so to kind of promo that if you aren't familiar with the U2 Eucharist and talk a little bit about U2 and their spiritual journey. But in the meantime, with everything else going on, I thought I would do a best of. What kind of triggered it was some recent emails from some listeners who've newly discovered the show and were going through some of the back episodes. And for those who've been listening for the 2 years I've been doing this now, you may recall it wasn't exactly an interview with Dave Slusher, but it was me, with Dave's permission, taking apart a podcast that he did that talked about why he is no longer a Christian. Why he no longer believes in God. These folks had listened to it and found it very fascinating and were referencing how they have shared it with other folks. And what kind of brought it back to mind is I was doing some cleaning around the house as we were taking down the Christmas tree and such and came across November's issue of Wired Magazine. The cover article was The New Atheism, No Heaven, No Hell, Just Science, The Crusade Against Religion. And the article itself is absolutely fascinating, and it echoes much of what Dave's journey was specifically. To read the article, though, the primary contributors are, biographies, are scientists who, through their encounters with science, has taken them to a point where it is not simply discounting the existence of God, but I guess how I'd put it, becoming crusaders against God, which is a different position than where Dave is at. But I would really suggest the Wired article. I'll put a link on the webpage, and we'll probably say a little more about the article in detail. But what I'm going to do is this week and next week is repost the interviews with or the podcasts from last year for folks to listen to, and then discuss a little bit about what that means with the new atheism, so to speak, and then the alternative that's offered by the folks from U2. So enjoy this best of, and see you out there on the road. Wired Jesus Podcast, July 15th, 2005.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
Wired Jesus Podcast.
I walk a lonely road, the only one that I have ever known. Don't know where it goes, but it's only me and I walk alone.
Wired wanderings of a postmodern pilgrim.
And you will know my name is the Lord vengeance upon thee.
Well, I don't like your God. Your God scares me.
My boy, we're pilgrims in an unholy land.
Hello, and welcome to the Wired Jesus Podcast, the wired wanderings of a postmodern pilgrim. I'm your host and fellow traveler, Tom Lieberg, and I'm glad you've come along for our journey together. As I said in the last podcast, and I've been promising for a while, with this episode, we'll be taking some time to walk you through Dave Slusher's audio essay, Why I Don't Believe in God, which he recorded as the January 31st episode of the Evil Genius Chronicles. One of the reasons that motivated me to start Wired Jesus was this very podcast. Being a pastor, we're often trained with the idea that if people hear the gospel, you know, hear it rightly, and hear about the life and love of Jesus, they will turn their lives around and just naturally follow him as if it's just perfectly human common sense. And evangelical Christian or mainline, we've lived with this conceit and this national delusion that, you know, really no one ever stops being Christian, even if they say they are. They just stop going to church, and when people grow up spiritually, they'll come back. Countless congregations have hung on to this belief that, you know, our kids grew up, they went off, and in their 20s and 30s, they kind of do their own thing. But when they start having kids, you know, they come back to church because that's familiar. Well, as many of you already know or are currently living, Gen Xers, we're two, three, even four generations removed from any type of religious traditions. Over half of us never even went to a church or a synagogue or any type of organized religious upbringing. So there's nothing to go back to. Now, Dave's journey and honesty are really a cold slap in reality for Christians and leaders like me on how the landscape has really changed. It's no longer all about people not liking your congregation or not liking the personality of the pastor, the friendliness of the community. You know, we kind of think if we're friendly people, if the pastor's nice, you know, folks will come. Postmoderns are coming from a completely different direction, have serious questions, and have been seriously let down by the pat and simplistic answers of what I would describe as our domesticated, nationalized Christianity of North America, and I'd include Western Europe as well. So, as I've told other pastors, and say again to the pastors I know who listen to Wired Jesus, Dave's podcast is required listening. If you want to understand the free fall of the Christian mainline, the stagnation in the evangelical movement, and the spiritual surge of postmoderns, which is going in directions away from Christianity, all you need to do is let your leaders, be it pastors, be it, you know, evangelism committees or team leaders, have them listen to Dave and see if you, your evangelism team, your congregational leadership, if they can even bear to listen. Because if there isn't space in the Christian community that you worship in to address Dave's questions, to listen to the pain and delusionment, and refuse to give in to the same simple-minded answers that Dave was given, if you can't do that, then you may as well resign yourself to the reality that most postmoderns will want nothing to do with your congregation, with you, or your Jesus. My plan for this podcast and the next podcast or two is just to play Dave's essay and insert my own comments and reflections on what he says. I had asked Dave a while ago if I could have permission to do that and made it clear, you know, this is not a podcast to convince Dave to change his mind. And I hope to avoid, you know, that trap of you know, becoming the pastor answer man, kind of a vocational hazard, I guess. But instead, just reflect what I hear in Dave's journey, how that speaks to me, and how it challenges how we go about understanding what a spiritual journey of meaning and significance means in the 21st century. And how some folks have very legitimately simply walked away from that. So here's the first part of Dave's podcast from the Evil Genius Chronicles, January 31st, 2005.
Hello, friends and neighbors. This is Dave Slusher. This is the Evil Genius Chronicles, evilgeniuschronicles.org, for Monday, January 31st, 2005. This is an atypical show. There will be no music, no theme music, no sponsorship, no shenanigans. This will be a single topic. The whole show will be my audio essay about why I don't believe in God. And through a technical problem, I actually recorded this whole thing earlier today. Lost it all, was heartbroken. It was a 50-minute episode of me spilling my guts, and it's all gone. And I'm hoping that the spontaneity remains and that it doesn't sound rote the second time, because there was some pretty heartfelt stuff in there. So I'll soldier forward, and as we will get to later, if it went this way, it must be God's will, right? God planned it. God wanted me to lose the first cut of this. So, before we get into this, and I talk about my atheism and my struggles with faith and why I don't believe in God, it really doesn't make sense to talk about that unless I give some of my religious history. And I guess I did this in about 5 or 6 or 7 minutes the first time. We'll see how it goes this time. When I was a kid, I guess around 10 or 11 years old, I made the decision for myself that I wanted to be born again and to begin living in Christ, and I joined a Christian church in Norton, Kansas. And it should be stressed that no one else in my family at the time was involved in any church. Nobody stopped me or discouraged me at all, but neither did anyone encourage me. I just sort of made this decision that that's what I wanted to do, and I was counseled by a great guy, the youth minister of that church, a guy named Doug Engmeyer, who's everything you want in a youth minister. He was pretty young himself. He, at the time, rode a motorcycle. So as he came to counsel me about my upcoming baptism, he would ride his hog up to the house and then talk to me about Jesus. And, that had a certain coolness factor to it. And I was baptized. And he's the man who baptized me. And I still remember the warning he gave me, because they don't change the water in the tank like every week. They change it, before it gets scummy. But, it can get a little dodgy. And he was warning me a little about that. And I gave him a line. I was like 10 years old, right? I was a little kid. And he said, the water can get a little dirty. And I said, well, of course it gets dirty. It's got all the sins in it. And as far as I know, he's probably still using that line. He used it for a long time. That was 20-some-odd years ago. But, so, I made the decision. I got baptized, decided that I was born again. And I became pretty active in my church. I, throughout my early and mid-teens, I did things like guest taught, did sermons sometimes in the Sunday evening church. I can't remember the name of the Christian comedy troupe, but they had, in the church library, they had some Christian comedy albums, and I actually memorized some of the routines, and I would perform them in church, and I'd perform in the Sunday, like these Christian monologues. And, I actually enjoyed doing that kind of thing, and I joined the Bible Bowl team, which, if you're not familiar with that, it's a quiz system. Every year they pick a chunk of the Bible that you are quizzed on, and so everybody studies the same chunk of the Bible, and you go to these competitions. And I was pretty good at it. This is kind of where the smart, churchy kids gravitate to, and I was on a team, I guess, when I was maybe a sophomore in high school. It's on a team that came in somewhere around 10th or 12th in the nation. And so, we're not monkeys here. We came in, 12th out of 200 teams in the country. And so because of this, I actually was earning scholarships. Some of these tournaments would be put on by Bible colleges. And one of the perks is if you win one of those, often the prize included some form of scholarship, like a $500,000 a year scholarship to their Bible college, which at the time, I thought I was on the career path to become a minister. I wanted to be a preacher. That's what I was heading for. You know, I was doing already doing sermons. I was actually doing biblical scholarship above and beyond the Bible bowl stuff. And it's just what I thought I wanted to do with my life. So I competed extra hard at those church tournaments because, particularly in Manhattan Christian College, which is across the street from Kansas State, I always stepped up my game there because that's actually where I wanted to go to school. You could get a dual degree with Kansas State and Manhattan Christian College. And I thought, oh boy, I can really do this. And we never did win that. We came in, I think second or third was the best we did. But like every time we played there, I was like, oh, let's win this one. Let's win this one. Never did it. We did win first place at the Norfolk Christian College or Norfolk Bible College or whatever in Norfolk, Nebraska. And, you know, it was like $1,000 or $2,000 a year scholarship, which I don't know what tuition was, but, you know, in 1983, that was pretty good. And so that's kind of where I was at.
Okay, just a couple comments at this point. If you know, Dave was baptized at age 10, and so his first contact with the church is the same as many of us who are postmoderns, Gen X, particularly Gen Xers, is with the whole big evangelical kind of mega church boom of the 80s. You know, baby boomers were just flocking to these big churches that were often criticized about being more about entertainment than substance. One thing that these churches did very, very well, though, was youth-focused ministry to draw kids like Dave's, because the assumption was if you got the kids in a church, the parents are going to follow. And so there were countless postmodern kids who were drawn into a Christian community because their parents, you know, still kind of the baby boomer thing of letting kids, you know, find your own way and their own religion thing. And I'm not sure if that was the case with Dave's parents or not. I had several friends who were kind of that way, where, you know, let the kid choose whatever religion he wants. But these big evangelical churches were very good in drawing kids in, providing them a community, and then baptizing them. And that kind of, you know, became a certain sense their family. And if you know, many of them were, you know, like Dave, were very excited about this community of kids that they were in with, you know, the cool youth pastors and all that, to the point where Dave was even interested in becoming a pastor. And for pastor types like us, like me, this is always a very exciting and scary thing to hear from a kid. You know, it's cool to realize that you're a role model, and it's scary, and that kids are drawn to that. But it's scary to realize that there's a downside to being a pastor that they probably don't see at that point. You know, the time commitments, the criticism, the disrespect. I once had my butt chewed royally by a parent when I suggested that their kid had the gifts for becoming a pastor. Their attitude at the time was pretty much their kid was too smart for a crap job like mine. You know, you want to warn them that being a pastor has a very real downside. But, you know, Dave was drawn to that, and there, like I said, there were a lot of us where, you know, in those early adolescent years, that was our contact with Christianity and a spiritual life because, hey, our parents weren't into it.
As I got further and further along in my teenage years, the stress fractures started to form. Part of it was sort of questioning this. As I got more inquisitive and I worked harder and dug deeper, I found that I actually believed less in what I was saying. And part of it was some very bad examples by people. Some, you know, there's a lot of great people in the church, and there's also some real shit heels in the church. And the thought that these people who, in some ways, were bad people, like frauds and cheats and liars, thought, are these people going to heaven? I mean, they're doing all the stuff that I hear that you're supposed to go to heaven for, but they're like bad, immoral people. These are the people that are going to heaven too? That just doesn't seem right to me. Some of it had to do, I'm sure a little bit of contribution had to do with my getting a job in radio, such that many Sunday mornings I was actually in the radio station, and I just found that once I stopped going to church, because I, you know, had to work, I still did Bible Bowl stuff, and but I found that I actually liked not being in church. And so, over the course of my teenage years, I just decided this wasn't for me. And we moved from that little town in Kansas to Augusta, Georgia, between my junior and senior year in high school, and I sort of had this opportunity to remake myself. And I just didn't do... I decided I had no involvement in a church. I didn't care. I wasn't, you know, this... I decided that this was a thing that was no longer part of me. And so I just, at one point, I gave my life to Jesus, and then at a later point, I took it back from Jesus.
That's a telling line, you know, gave my life to Jesus, and then I took it back. It's the experience of a lot of folks. Church can become oppressive. And the fractures that Dave talks about in teenage years, it's kind of the questions you aren't supposed to ask in church at all, you know. You start looking around as you get older, you know. As a teen, you start to look at adults a little bit differently than you do it as kids, and you start to see some of their flaws, you know. These are the people who are going to heaven, you know. These hypocrites are saved Christians. You know, particularly coming out of an evangelical tradition, your understanding of being saved and born again starts to fragment when you realize, you know, it really doesn't change human brokenness. That people who worship every Sunday and are, you know, elected or appointed as leaders, in the church can still be jerks or worse. How does that make sense with, you know, baptism and born again and you know, living a Christian life, particularly when other folks who may not be doing that are just kind of winking at the reality that, you know, hey, these folks are, you know, their lives are a mess, they're a poor example, but, you know, hey, they give enough money to the church where, you know, we'll let them slide. To go on, you know, I gave my life to Jesus and I took it back. That really isn't unusual. And like I said earlier, the pattern for, you know, a number of years has been the thought, you know, your teens are going to rebel, you leave the church in your 20s, and then you come back. What Dave's saying here is not unusual. That's part of our generation, and sadly, too many folks in the church don't even get that. We've been so used to, you know, preaching to our own kids and dragging them into church as a good habit that we have very little idea on how to deal with people who have walked away or were never part of a church culture or community. And so when... you know, Christians hear Dave say something like that and said, oh, that sounds awful. No, for most Potterns, that sounds quite liberating, and Dave's right on target.
Like, no, Jesus, you don't get this anymore. I don't even believe in you. You don't get my life anymore. So that's kind of like the you know, 30 years boiled down into a couple minutes. And, you know, so for the time, it's particularly those texts of the Bible that I studied, I actually know a lot about the Bible. I, you know, for Genesis and Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, and the epistles of Paul. You know, I went through those with fine-tooth combs as a Bible bowler, and I know a lot about the Bible in those stretches. You know, I've forgotten way more than I still remember, but I was a biblical scholar, a teen biblical scholar on that stuff. So then the question becomes, what is this belief system that I have now? Kind of how did I get from Christianity to where I am now? There was a period in time where I thought I was agnostic. I was more, I actually didn't ever call myself agnostic. I said I was sort of an apathist. I said, it was kind of like, I don't know if there's a God, and I don't really care. That was kind of a little different from agnostic. And then somewhere along the line, I've just decided that no, in fact, I am straight atheist. I don't believe that there is a God. One of the things that has always bugged me about when you kind of, you know, I don't debate with people about whether or not there's a God. It's the nature of my belief system that I'm not going to proselytize anybody. And in some ways, I think that puts me above the Christians because it's part of their philosophy that I am wrong, I need help, I must be changed. And it's part of my philosophy that whatever you think, whatever's making you happy, whatever's working for you, go with that. You do what you need to do. Life is very hard. And if believing in Jesus and devoting yourself to Jesus and thinking that all that stuff is going to get you in heaven, if that makes this very difficult life easier for you, by gum, that's what you should do.
That's a thoroughly postmodern view. And Dave's right. Christians have often abused the call to evangelize and turned it into what... some of the Christian rulers of Europe did back in the Middle Ages. You know, you gather up the village, you march them all by spear point down to the edge of a river and say, okay, we're going to baptize you all today and you're going to all become good Christians, or we're going to kill you. Your choice. Well, gee, you know, giving my life to Jesus right then looks real good. We've got our modern versions of that. And you'll see some of those. I remember these little comic books I used to find. People would leave them in the door at the house to bug my dad. My dad is a retired pastor, and it's this little thing. You know, you need to give your life to Jesus, or you're going to burn in hell. And these little black and white comics would show, you know, people who made wrong decisions, and this giant TV that's beside God to show, you know, how you didn't make the right decision. So, you know, you're going to burn in hell. And the moral of the comic book is, you better change your life right now. You're going to end up just like that. I believe Jesus lived differently. That Jesus gave an example to draw people, but not to make people follow him. There are far too many people who let walk away for that to happen. But, you know, the thought, you live your life as whatever helps you get through this difficult life, and if Jesus does that for you, great. If he doesn't, that's great too. Got to understand that if you're going to deal with postmoderns, because you try and force postmoderns like us into, you know, a black and white decision, you know, heaven or hell, we'll walk away and not accept either.
But I don't want to change. I don't want to change your mind. I don't really care. You know, that's your decision. But oddly enough, my decision seems to be everyone else's business. That's just one of the ways this works out. People want to bring me to Jesus, and I don't want to bring anyone away from Jesus. So I claim a little bit of moral high ground on that. I claim a little superiority in the tolerance front, because you living your life the way you want to is not an affront to me. One of the things that's always bugged me about people who talk about God, and even when I was religious, it's bugged me a little. And this is the kind of thing... the kind of line of reasoning that led me away from the church was the way people treat anything that happens as evidence of God. If something really good happens, that's a sign of God's blessing. Ah, God is so wonderful. He made this wonderful thing happen for all of us. That's great. If something bad happens, it's like, oh, God tests us sometimes. God doesn't test us beyond what we're able to bear. And there's, you know... You read some passage out of Job justifying misery. Oh, you know, when there's misery, it's just all part of God's plan. It's the way God wants it to be. And when things happen that are neutral, you know, that's God too. So then you take the principle of falsibility and you say, okay, all these things are evidence of God. Because of the way all these things are, because of God, life is the way it is. Now let's do a thought experiment. Imagine God, because only God can do this, God with his omniscience decided to remove himself from this universe. Beep. God's gone. How does life change? How is life different if there is not a God from how there is when there is a God? What aspect of your life will be different? There's no aspect that will be different, right? I mean, what can you point to that would suddenly change if there were no God? You can't prove that there's a God. Instead, what's supposed to get you to heaven is your faith, your willingness to believe something that you can't reason, that you can't prove, that there's really nothing to make you believe. And this is the aspect that gets you to heaven. So God makes man, and he makes man inquisitive. That's what separates us from all the other animals. We're able to question ourselves. We're able to question God. God created man able to question God. But you aren't supposed to ask the questions, and you're not supposed to pursue them, and you're not supposed to use that talent to realize there is no God. You're not supposed to use that to reason against God. You're just supposed to, what the aspect that will get you into heaven for all eternity is believing something on a whim. to just take something with no evidence, and that's the aspect. It has always bothered me, the kind of religious gamesmanship, because you've got Earth, where we're born into, and we live for, I don't know, 80 years, 40 years, 60 years, 100 years. And then, after that mortal time, you spend eternity in heaven. Why do we have to do the 40 years, or the 60 years, or the 100 years? Why don't we just go straight to heaven? Why do we even have to do this? Why does this omniscient God create this bizarrely arbitrary thing where you got eternity, but first you got to go through the shadow play on Earth? You know, that's just how the paperwork is. You know, I'm God, I'm omniscient, I could create anything the way it is, but we've got this little procedure you have to go through. And if you don't believe in me, and you don't love me and devote your life to me, now you're not going to be able to tell I'm around, but you got to do that anyway. You know, let's just take that as a given. And if you don't do that, then you go to hell. And you go to hell for eternity. But if you believe this unbelievable thing, then you go to heaven for all eternity. And so there's a gamesmanship where if you think this through and assume that all that is, there is a God and that is how it goes. If I died in a car wreck when I was 14 years old, I'd have gone to heaven. If I die on an airplane tomorrow, I'm going to hell. I had the misfortune, through dumb luck, to survive the period where I had given my life to Jesus and into the period of my apostasy. And because of that, I'm going to hell. So I had, you know, a 6 or 7 year window where I could have gone to heaven. Yeah, but I blew that. Oh, gosh. Poor me. I outlived that. I outlived my Christianity, and thus I'm going to hell. But if I had been lucky enough to die then, I would be in heaven right now.
Dave's right on here. This is one of the things that has just fried me for years, even long before I even thought of becoming a pastor, is this idea that to be a Christian is nothing more than to get into heaven. That, you know, you join you become a church member, which really often has nothing to do with Jesus, but, you know, you join a church in order so you can go to heaven. So because you have a church membership, because you've been baptized, or because you've made this public decision for Jesus, you know, you get into heaven free card type of thing, you know, the Monopoly board stuff. And that's all there is to it. Everything is about staying on the good side of God, so when you die, you're going to get rewarded. And, you know, folks have rightly, you know, criticized the Emperor Constantine, who gave the big push for Christianity to become the official religion of the Roman Empire. He refused to get baptized until on his deathbed, so he could still do whatever he wanted, and then right at the end claim, you know, now I've been baptized, God's forgiven me, I'm ready, I can die, so I got to screw around, and I still get to go into heaven. So like Dave said, we can turn into this divine, you know, gambling game with God, that, you know, and if I mess it up, if I die at the wrong time, you know, whatever, you know, a gracious God would have killed David 14 by this logic. If all that it's about is, you know, getting into heaven for eternity and you've got a, you know, 20, 40, you know, 80 year lifespan, to get it right. And if you screw it up, you're screwed up for eternity, which is big time business. And so this is gracious. This is loving. It turns, following Jesus, it turns a spiritual journey into something that really belongs more in Vegas than as religion.
You know, there's that gamesmanship bothers me. The fact that some of the guys I knew in college were some of the hardest partying, craziest bastards around. Some of the most amoral, drugging it up and drinking it up and sexing it up guys are also some of the ones who, in their mid-20s, late-20s, became very devoted to Jesus. And there's something about that where when you're a young man, you just live like there's no tomorrow. You party it up, live this life of hedonistic, amoral pleasure. You don't care if you hurt people. As long as you get what you're after, as long as you get your rocks off, that's fine. A few years down the road, when, frankly, nobody can sustain that pace of life because you're just getting too old and too tired, then, you know, okay, now we're going to Jesus. So now you're rolling the dice. You're gambling the opposite gamble that I had. You're gambling that you survive. All I got to do is survive long enough to get past this period so I can have a crazy youth and just, you know, go crazy and screw everything that moves. And just be a scumbag. And then if I live long enough to give my life to Jesus, then, you know, hey, there you go. I got my cake and I get to eat it too. I get eternity in heaven and I got a really fun college years. You know, 15 to 25, woohoo, those rocked. And now I get to make it to the heaven. I get the best of all worlds. Isn't that great? That's very cynical, and I'm not actually accusing my friends of having that thought process, but if you believe in God, and if you believe that because they gave their life to Jesus, that they're going to spend eternity in heaven, that's how it will have worked out. They managed to game God. They managed to work God's system to their advantage, that they got to spend their prime years with the devil and their aging years with Jesus. Isn't that nice for them? How wonderful. Well, it bothers me that people believe in this omniscient God who acts in these, who, if you note through history, God's omniscient, God's all-powerful, God made the world, God made people, and if you notice going through the Bible, God doesn't really have a great success record with man. In fact, God has screwed this up over and over and over again. In fact, he didn't even make it past two people before he had his first big meltdown. So, this omniscient God got off to an awfully slow start, didn't he? Two people. Can't even keep two people in line for a few years, and then paradise, it's all over. Got to cast him out. Got to, you know, throw the fit. And, oh, I'm tearing down. Don't make me turn around this Garden of Eden. Because, oh, you did it. I asked you not to do one thing and you did it. You too. Am I going to have to separate you, Adam and Eve? You're out. You're out of this garden. You can't even stand up from one temptation from one devil. God, what a failure. And then, you know, a few generations down the road, guess what? I got to destroy the whole world because people screwed up again. So God can't even... God had to destroy it. Sodom and Gomorrah. God had to create a whole class of people, the judges, who are simply going out to smite people who are not behaving. When Samson went out and had to slew 40,000 Philistines. I mean, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of slaying to do. And particularly with just like one bone. That's a hard day's work. And so God's omniscient, but he can't create a world and a set of people that he doesn't need to smite over and over and over again. And then
I love it. That's a hard day's work going out there smiting. Oh man, that is great. But you know, again, he has a point. What is up? As you read the Bible with this human race that God has created that can't seem to get anything right, that you know, God constantly has to smite or send other smiters to take care of him. It's all screwed. You know, Bill Cosby has a great routine about Adam and Eve. You know, everything's going fine. All of a sudden, eat the apple and whoop, you know, party's over. Everyone out of the pool type of thing. You know, that is one way of looking at it. And I'll say much more about what I believe personally and what I found to be true in my spiritual journey later on. You know, Dave needs to be heard here, because as we talk about different spiritual journeys, some come to an end, and in Dave's case, it has come to an end, and that's something any of us, Christian or otherwise, I think do well to listen to and understand, because, you know, those folks are us. They're our friends, they're our family, and it's not an us or them thing. They're part of the journey as well. So, back to Dave.
Then, God sets up the system such that the only way... He creates all these arbitrary rules, which, if you notice, are very much like survival rules for living in the desert. They involve a lot of things like, say, not eating pork, which, you know, may help if you're a tribe of people who's wandering in a desert and don't have a lot of resources for cooking, perhaps. So these things that are our moral laws nowadays, you know, if you go back through Leviticus, you know, God knows whenever Jerry Falwell finds something advantageous in Leviticus, a man who does not, for example, stone children to death when they talk back to their parents, but does use the adjacent passage in Leviticus to show homosexuality is wrong, cherry-picking the moral truths you want and ignoring the ones that are troublesome to you. But I digress. So you have all these Levitical laws and you have all these Hebraic laws, and God, omniscient, all-powerful, omnipotent, has hamstrung himself so thoroughly by his own rules that he's got to launch this crazy plan. Okay, I'm God, but in order to fulfill my own rules, because, you know, I have to, having made these rules by God, I have to stick to them. So there's got to be a sacrifice. And, you know, if it's not going to be sheep and if it's not going to be goats and cows, what I'm going to have to do is take a little piece of myself. And I'll find a virgin woman. And I'll make her have that baby of that little piece of myself. So she'll have a little God baby. And I'll have that little piece of me. I'll have that piece of me grow up. And then when I get old enough... I'll have some humans get together and nail the God baby to a cross. And then there you go. We've at that point, we've dotted the I's and crossed the T's and everything will be fine. So God, this is the best God can do. This plan has always seemed crazy to me. We're supposed to take this as kind of, oh yeah. And people say this, oh yeah, you know, Jesus came and he died for our sins. And nobody seems to question how little that makes sense. Why does anyone have to die for our sins? You know, the governor can grant you clemency, but with God, someone's got to die.
This is scary. And by that I mean, we often don't understand the Bible. Enough of us don't take the time to read the Bible. Dave has. You know, he was on the Quiz Bowl team. He knows the Bible here. And so often we Christians will take the Bible for granted. And when we find the parts of the Bible that confuse us, that we don't like, that don't seem to make sense, we kind of cross those off limits and keep it to ourselves. This sounds a little weird. The whole thing about cherry picking in the book of Leviticus. We've done a wonderful job, and those are perfectly legitimate examples of how we have piecemealed the Bible to use it quite often the way we want, and then ignore the pieces that undercut the argument we're trying to make. You sit down and try and tell someone for the first time, just the story of Jesus and who's been disconnected from that, and you kind of get a little bit of an idea as to how hard a job foreign missionaries have had, because Dave doesn't do a bad job of kind of pointing out some of these things, with the God baby and die and fulfill the laws. Why does someone have to die? The Christian term that theologians use is the doctrine of the atonement. Why does this have to happen? And even if it does, what difference does it make on how I live now? I say this not as as a pastor. I've got my own. Well, as a Christian, I've got my own way in which I've resolved that in my head. But we have, we all have to be willing to look at the parts of it that the questions we don't want to ask, the questions that aren't allowed to ask, but other people are asking. And my hunch is, plenty of us who have read the Bible and been Christian for years have been wondering the same thing and just haven't had the guts to say it.
I just kind of feel crazy for being the only... Am I the only person who notices that that doesn't actually seem to make a whole lot of sense? And yet, we've got 2,000 years of people killing each other for things like this. It just... It boggles my mind. So I'm kind of getting... I'm having a hard time focusing on this, but you kind of know where... You see where I'm getting. These are the kinds of issues that bother me, is that, I'm an inquisitive guy. I'm an engineer. I'm the kind of guy who likes to ask questions, and I like to explore the edges of things, and I like to extrapolate things out to where do they make sense and where do they not make sense. And all these aspects of Christianity that we're supposed to take on faith are hard to swallow to me. And people will say this all the time, well, you have to have faith. You've got to have faith. And like I was saying before, an analogous way of phrasing that is, you have to believe something that you rationally have no reason to believe. That, to me, does not seem like the kind of thing that should... That's worthy of... That's what gets you an eternity in paradise, is your ability to believe the unbelievable. That's it.
That's the first half of Dave's podcast. It's a 43-minute podcast, so we will do the other 20 minutes with the next podcast. Like I said, I just wanted to insert some of my comments and reflections and let Dave speak for himself. I think... And what I'm trying to do with this is really to paint a picture for you as to where many of us postmoderns are, and how I think in podcasts in particular, we can really have these kind of open, honest, and as you hear in the second half of this of Dave's podcast, really quite raw confessions of how we have encountered life, and how life has shaped us, and how this journey can take all kinds of different directions. And so for those of us who are engaged in what we openly call a spiritual journey, well, we need to understand those whose journey may have started that way, has become something quite different. That's it for this part of Wired Jesus podcast. This has been my longest one to date, and the next one will probably be about as long. I normally won't ever do any this long, but I think this one is worth listening to and hearing and reflecting on, and I hope you agree. Do be sure to check out Dave's website. The links are there on my podcast, on my site, Wired Jesus, or you can check him out at Evil. Did I say Wired Genius? Okay, it's getting late. WiredJesus.com, or you can check out Dave's site, EvilGenius.org, and lots of links to his podcast. Check him out. It is a great, great podcast with lots of topics other than this, but this is certainly a gem. Love the comments that are coming in. Loving how folks are listening to the podcast from around the world. I'm discovering I've got a lot of listeners now over in Scotland and UK. So thanks to all of you for the emails and comments, and keep them coming, and share the news with your friends. So thanks for walking with Wired Jesus, and see you out there on the road.
What if God was one of us? Just a slot like one of us. Blue, 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 blue. Blah, blah, blee, blee, blee. Well done. Very good.
Dr. Evil, that was fantastic.
Thank you, number two.
I wrote that.
Yeah.